Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's get to the docket. Well, there's closing arguments in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. The judge made some rulings. Well, the defense attorney's making some ridiculous arguments about who can and shouldn't be in the courtroom. We'll give you an update on the Summer Wells case. Well, we'll find out what happens when the wife meets the fiancé. A bizarre case in Atlanta, which is actually kind of scary. Ghislaine Maxwell finally talks, and it's not really about what you think she'd want to talk about. An example of evil, and finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel, the channel where you actually get a practicing criminal defense attorney that's going to explain to you the facts, the procedures, and the law to both current and cold cases. I hope you enjoy. All right. If you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit the like button, hit that little bell so you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content, and as always, leave me a comment below. With what we're going to talk about today, I'm assuming it's going to get some people all fired up. Don't forget, you can listen to this show and past shows by downloading Crime Talk on all of your favorite podcasting apps. Apple, Spotify, iHeart, Android, Amazon, and Audible as well. All right, now before we get to our business, we got to take care of some other business. Please go to crimetalkprep.com. When you go there, guess what you can do? You can order and claim your 3-month emergency food kit. Why would you need to do that? Well, it's the smart thing to do. We've all noticed the supply chain isn't what it used to be. That's for sure. Who thought, and I never thought in my lifetime, I would go to the store and actually look at shelves where food is unavailable. Never thought in my life, never happened in my life, at least as far as I can remember. So be prepared for the unexpected. Go to crimetalkprep.com and order your 3 months. And when you do that, when you order your 3-month emergency food kit, guess what? $100 off. That's what you're going to get. And it's going to be the right choice. And hopefully you never need it. It's insurance. Hopefully you never need it. But like all insurance, it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. Today is Monday, November 15th. But before we get to the show, let's do a couple of housekeeping matters. I apologize. We didn't do a show last Friday. Why? That's right. Had to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma for a client's matter. And it was a busy day. Left early, got a little bit delayed, got even more delayed when we got to Tulsa because of some things at the courthouse. Not a big deal. Basically got back about 8:30 Friday evening. But hey, Crime Talk 1 came in just perfectly. And with the tailwinds going out, we were going at jet speeds. It was amazing. A little longer coming home, that's for sure. All right, let's get to it. Closing arguments in the Rittenhouse case. All right, some people want to talk about the Rittenhouse case, other people don't. Thursday, we went through the jury instructions that the court was going to give. And guess what? Well, the judge made a decision early, and he had dismissed count 6 from the Kyle Rittenhouse charge sheet. What charge was that? Illegal possession of a firearm. Judge Schroeder dropped the charge Monday morning after the state, that's right, the prosecutor, had to concede that the rifle carried by Mr. Rittenhouse on August 25th of 2020 was more than 16 inches. Why does that matter? Well, it's not against the law to carry a rifle if it's above 16 inches. Who would be upset by this? Well, a lot of people seem to be. But guess what? The law was not written by the judge. The law was written by the legislature. The prosecutor had to do it. Now, I'm a little surprised that it took this amount of time for somebody from the prosecution side to actually go and measure the firearm to see if it was in fact a violation of the law. Scary, ladies and gentlemen. It was the defense that had to actually measure that and present that evidence. The prosecution didn't even care. Don't you think they'd want to double check the facts? I guess it just doesn't matter. But that's why we have defense attorneys. That's right. Because, well, frankly, when the prosecution says something or state says something is true, you can't assume that it is actually true, because a lot of the time it is not. But at least the prosecution finally agreed on the day of closing arguments that it was not an illegal weapon, even though they went through their entire case saying that it was an illegal weapon to be carried. It was not. What the law did state is that anyone under 18 to carry a short-barreled rifle and a rifle with a barrel shorter than 16 inches, but it's not illegal to carry a longer rifle in the state of Wisconsin. Now, the prosecution is staking their case on the evidence that the judge warned Monday morning could, well, as he stated it, fall like a house of cards. Now, the judge made his comments as he and the attorneys for both sides finalized the jury instructions to be read to the jury ahead of closing arguments that took place this morning. Well, the judge was referring to the drone footage that shows Rittenhouse pointing his gun at people before he allegedly shoots Joseph Rosenbaum. Well, he did. The question is whether it was self-defense. The defense argued unsuccessfully for the image, blurry at best, and enhanced using an algorithm that the state's expert witness admitted to not understanding to be excluded from the evidence. Judge Schroeder ultimately decided to allow the image into evidence, stating that he would allow the jury to decide what importance to give that evidence to the case. And then today, when the point was raised once more, he warned the assistant district attorney, Mr. Krause in this case, this technicality is not being used to decide which camera I'm going to buy at a store. This is being used to decide whether someone is guilty or not guilty of a crime. I don't want to be meddling or commenting on the evidence, but I will tell you this, assuring that there is a conviction, one or more, assuming that other motions don't contaminate the outcome, if it comes out at some time that the method used produced unreliable results, this is going to fall like a house of cards. So what does that really mean? Well, the judge is the gatekeeper of evidence. And if you recall the testimony, and some of you may have watched it, where their expert witness basically said, hey, things were done with algorithms, and you know, I just tried to enhance it, made some pixels, and I can't really tell you what color it was before, or I can show you what it is now, but I don't understand how it got there, what did it, how it did it, or anything along those lines. Kind of iffy that it should even be allowed in at all, in my humble opinion, but the judge said, you know, I'll allow it, we'll let the jurors give the weight that it deserves. But the judge said, if there's an issue that this turns out to be basically a snake oil salesman trying to say this is what we think it should be at best, he's going to basically throw the case out, particularly if there's some sort of post-conviction relief. So, and obviously Kyle Rittenhouse has resources at his disposal, so there will certainly be some investigation, particularly if there is in fact a conviction. So, I don't know. The prosecution was not exactly endearing themselves to the prosecution. I think they stepped over the line several times in this particular case. So what are the charges that Rittenhouse is actually going to face? First degree reckless homicide, use of a dangerous weapon. Now, the judge denied a prosecution request for the jury also to be able to be instructed on second degree reckless homicide. Now, Rittenhouse testified he acted in self-defense when he fatally shot Rosenbaum after the man threw a plastic bag at him and chased him. Now, under cross-examination, Rittenhouse said he knew Rosenbaum was unarmed. He said he was pointing his rifle at Rosenbaum in an attempt to deter him and acknowledged that it was in fact dangerous. Count two, first degree, recklessly endangering safety, use of a dangerous weapon. It's alleged that Rittenhouse recklessly endangered the safety of Richard McGinnis, a journalist with the conservative Daily Caller, under circumstances that show an utter disregard for human life. Count three, first degree, recklessly endangering safety, use of a dangerous weapon. It's alleged that Rittenhouse recklessly endangered the safety of an unknown male, referred to as Jump Kick Man in court, under circumstances that show utter disregard for human life. The man jumped at Rittenhouse at one point, trying to kick him, and the teen opened fire. I thought if we were to be knocked out, he would have stomped my face if I didn't fire, according to Rittenhouse's testimony. He fired at the man twice and missed. Now, count four is first-degree intentional homicide, use of a dangerous weapon. It's alleged that Rittenhouse caused the death of Mr. Huber, with the intent to kill him in the most serious charge he faces with a mandatory life sentence. Huber swung his skateboard at Rittenhouse after Rosenbaum was fatally shot. Count five, attempted first-degree intentional homicide, use of a dangerous weapon, referring to Mr. Grosskreutz. Rittenhouse attempted to cause the death of Grosskreutz with the intent to kill him. That's alleged. And after shooting Huber, Rittenhouse testified he saw Grosskreutz lunge at him and point a pistol at his head. Rittenhouse shot him, as he testified. Grosskreutz was wounded, and Grosskreutz testified he pulled out his own firearm because he believed Rittenhouse was an active shooter. Count six, that's the possession of a dangerous weapon. That was dismissed. Count seven, failure to comply with an emergency order from state or local government. So let's talk a little bit about the jury instructions. Now, the prosecution was requesting lesser included offenses. Okay, what does that really mean? Well, let's take the example of, in most cases, you have first-degree homicide, first-degree murder, and you can change the name for various states, but usually you have first-degree murder, second-degree murder, reckless, negligence, right? Those are all lesser-included offenses that one could be found guilty, maybe not necessarily guilty of first-degree murder, but they could say it was reckless or second-degree. It was knowing, but it wasn't after deliberation, all right? Usually, okay, and I'm telling you, usually, it is the defense that requests lesser included offenses, right? Because if the defendant is charged with first degree murder, as a defense attorney, you always want to have the lesser included offenses included in the instructions, so it gives the jury an out for a lesser charge. Very rarely, if ever, does the prosecution request lesser included offenses. The prosecution asks for lesser included offenses if, well, their case doesn't go as planned. Okay. And here's the defense was saying, we don't want the lesser included. We're going all in. And I've done that a couple of times, said, Judge, we don't want any lessers. But guess what? If somebody requests the lesser included offenses and there's evidence to support that, well, there is, because there's a lesser included offense. The mental state is less. It's going to be given. So I just think it's a little ironic that the prosecution is the one asking for the lesser included offenses. That means they're hoping to get something out of this trial. Now, if the prosecutor truly believed in his case, he would say, I don't want any lesser included offenses. I want nothing but the original charges, because that's what I believed when I filed this case, that I could ethically prove beyond to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what we have proven beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. Clearly, the prosecution doesn't think that. Now, the prosecution started their opening statement, and remember, the defense goes, and then the prosecution gets their chance for their final closing. That's just the way it is in the legal system. Those who have the burden, here it's the state, they have the burden, they get to go first, and then they get to go last. Always happens in a criminal case. The first closing by the prosecution was pretty straightforward, which was basically, Kyle Rittenhouse, bad man, some sort of carpetbagger coming to this place, to Kenosha, Wisconsin, to cause trouble, looking for trouble. He shouldn't have been there. Oh, and by the way, he lied about being an EMT, so he's a liar, liar, liar. That's the gist of it. He basically also said, and I'm not saying basically, he basically said all the people out there protesting, rioting, were heroes, and that they had a right to be there, which I agree, except when they start burning and raping and pillaging and all that other type of stuff that you throw in when you start rioting. But as the jury instructions read, and we talked about these, we actually read them, it doesn't matter why Rittenhouse was present. It only matters the circumstances at the particular time that he fired the shots. All the other stuff, irrelevant. But it's argument. The prosecution argued. The defense, pretty straightforward. Hey, my kid, you may not like him, but guess what? He had a right to defend himself. He was being chased. He was not the one out there causing, looking at trouble. It was all these other people who, and there was testimony that people had felony convictions, and they testified. That can go to their credibility. The juror can consider that when it comes to their credibility. So we're going to have to wait and see. As of the filming of this, the prosecution has not completed their second closing. And we are just going to have to wait and see what the jury does. And let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, you never know what a jury is going to do. I have lost cases that I thought I was in the money on, and I have won cases that I should have lost. you never know what a jury is going to do. Now, obviously, 12 jurors will deliberate. There are alternate jurors. They will be excused, and they will more than likely be basically told, hey, don't talk to anybody just yet, because if somebody gets sick, we're going to call you next. And we'll have to wait and see whether there's a conviction of some, all, or none of the charges. And obviously, we will try to bring it to you here on Crime Talk when that happens. Next on the docket, the Ahmaud Arbery case. And as we mentioned in the opening, the defense attorney, or one of the defense attorneys, is making some ridiculous arguments. Well, the Reverend Jesse Jackson made an appearance at the Ahmaud Arbery murder trial, and he is sticking it to one of the defense attorneys who openly griped about, quote, black pastors in court. That's right. Last week, Kevin Goh, defense attorney for William Roddy Bryan, said he wanted the judge to limit the number of black pastors allowed in the courtroom because he feared it could be consciously or unconsciously an attempt to pressure or influence the jury. Now, Goh reiterated his complaint once again, asking the judge to boot Reverend Jackson and presumably black pastors from the courtroom. The attorney said, how many pastors does the Arbery family have? We had the Reverend Al Sharpton here last week, and I'm not keeping track, but I don't know who Reverend Jackson's pastoring here. Now, Goh singled out Reverend Jackson for being in the courtroom, even though he never attended before today. Anyway, the judge denied his request. Reverend Jackson blasted Goh's motion as unacceptable because a public trial involves public observation. Yes, I totally agree. All right. This is a basic fundamental concept, ladies and gentlemen. And Mr. Goh, he knows better. Okay. We here in the United States have a right to a public trial. That means you cannot exclude somebody from that trial to watch unless they are causing some sort of a disturbance. There's no indication. Anybody can walk in. You all, any one of the subscribers here, any one of the viewers could walk into a courtroom and sit down and watch any trial that's going on, whether it be civil or criminal. It's fundamental. It's one's constitutional rights, you know, the right to hold fair and public trial, right, ladies and gentlemen? That's right. You can't exclude anybody. Cases have been reversed when they judge will exclude somebody from the courtroom. You simply can't do it. Very limited circumstances, and that's usually if there is some disturbance or threats being made by somebody in the courtroom, okay? It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. Mr. Goh should know better. I think he was probably trying to be a zealous advocate for his client, and well, let's just say I hope for his sake it just didn't come out the way he meant it, but it sure didn't come across very well for his client. Now, thank goodness the jury didn't see it, but I'm sure if they've been watching the news, which they probably have, because jurors are, they have a tendency to do that, well, guess what? They'll find out. Anyway, bad argument by Mr. Goh. Don't make those arguments. You just look bad, and well, it makes you look like, well, a racist. Just saying. I don't think you are. I don't know you, but I'm just saying, don't do it. All right, next on the docket, quick Summer Wells update. That's right. It's been nearly 5 months since the Amber Alert for a missing five-year-old in Northeast Tennessee. Law enforcement officials said they're being tight-lipped about portions of the investigation to preserve the integrity of the investigation, but said that the search is far from over. Summer Moon Utah Wells was last seen at her home in Beach Creek community of Hawkins County, Tennessee, on the afternoon of June 15th. Officials from more than four dozen agencies turned the Beach Creek community upside down, looking for the young girl for weeks. Specialized units searched more than 1,000 acres by foot and air. Dive teams were also brought in to search nearby lakes and ponds. Now, investigators said they have sifted through thousands of tips, but have been met with mostly dead ends. Most tips are generated by well-intentioned individuals on social media who've been spreading speculation and conjecture rather than having any real firsthand knowledge, according to the investigators. While the active search has long been suspended, law enforcement officials say they will do any search based upon credible information, but that information has been lacking. They're also urging all residents in the area to continue to check their properties, especially as overgrowth dies down due to the cooler weather, for any evidence Summer may have been on the property. As you may recall, how easy it is. Well, Brian Laundry, right? They apparently, the investigators, searchers, walked by that area numerous times. So hopefully something will turn up. The bottom line is they're still looking. No suspects whatsoever. The police say that they would like to find and talk to the owner of a 1998 to 2000 maroon or red Toyota Tacoma with a full bed, ladder rack, and white buckets in the truck of the bed. Now, a witness who is regularly in the area as part of his job spotted the truck in the area. Investigators would like to speak to the driver. Don Wells, Summer's father, has been convicted of multiple violent felonies and served prison time for convictions involving drugs and burglaries in Arkansas, Utah, and Texas. Now, this was in the late 90s and early 2000s, and he was cited for numerous parole violations. He also had a recent run-in and received a driving under the influence charge. Now, Summer's mother, Candace Bly, also has a criminal record out of the state of Wisconsin. Most recently, a guilty plea for domestic abuse back in 2003. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that they did anything wrong, but it just is something that the police have to consider. No one's been accused. We're certainly not accusing them of committing any crime. We give all the presumption of innocence for sure. And we would note that Summer's parents are continuing to cooperate fully with the investigation, and that is per the sheriff. Next on the docket, what happens when the wife meets the fiance? Well, in 2016, Jessica Devani was dating Gregory Bender, a successful hedge fund manager who lived near Orlando, Florida. What Jessica didn't know at the time was that Greg had been keeping a secret from her. The secret would be exposed while he was recovering from a medical procedure at the local hospital. Devani had met Bender online in 2009. He was 42 years old, and Devani was nearly 20 years his junior. It felt like we'd known each other all our lives. He became my best friend. That's as the romance developed. Devani said she noticed Bender had a streak of jealousy in him, and sometimes it would escalate into verbal threats. She said that she never feared what he could do to me, but she feared that he could do to other men. Now, despite his flaws, she remained with him, and eventually they got engaged. A few years after their engagement, Devani was confronted with a shocking twist in their relationship. Bender had undergone a procedure, and while he was recuperated in the ICU, Devani decided to drop by for a surprise visit. When she entered his room, another woman was there. That was Damara Sanchez, his wife at the time. And needless to say, she was like, what is she doing here? And she's like, well, what are you doing here? And so she told her, well, I'm his fiance. And I showed her the ring. And then she showed me her ring. And she's like, well, I'm his wife. That's what Miss Devani recalls. Now, several days passed before Bender finally contacted Devani to explain the situation. He explained to her that it was strictly a marriage of convenience, so he could help the woman's son attend a better school district. Jessica says that she took him back, but she issued an ultimatum that he had to divorce his wife. However, for months, Bender stalled, and Devani says she eventually dumped him. A month later, in June of 2017, she met 25-year-old Patrick De La Cerda on a dating app. And she stated, I was afraid that he would find out about our relationship. This is according to Ms. Devani again. Now, Devani says Bender learned about the new relationship with De La Cerda from Facebook. And she said that's when Bender started messaging De La Cerda and threatening him. Within months, Devani says Bender would leave alarming messages to them both. In one voicemail, Bender said, I'm giving instructions and I'm going to have my plan put into action. Eventually, both Devani and De La Cerda had enough, and Devani asked the judge for a restraining order against Bender. Well, the order, issued in December of 2017, stated Bender could not contact Devani and he had to hand over his firearms. Now, the couple were now excited about their future without the looming threat of Bender, according to Devani, and by the end of 2017, De La Cerda proposed to Devani. Now, De La Cerda presented Devani with a temporary engagement ring while he waited for the delivery of a ring he had designed. But the day De La Cerda would give Devani that ring never came. On February 27th of 2018, Jessica received two unexpected calls from Bender. Now, fearing for De La Cerda's safety, she tried to reach him, but he didn't answer his phone. That's when she rushed over to De Lacerda's home and found him dead in a pool of blood. Soon after sheriff deputies arrived, Devani told them about Bender. Another break in the case came when a detective got a tip from another woman in Bender's life. Bender's now ex-wife, Demara Sanchez, the woman Devani says she met visiting Bender at the hospital years earlier. Demara, who had watched news reports about De Lacerda's murder, told investigators about a murder plan she had found, which she says Bender wrote laying out a plot to kill De Lacerda. And once she told us about the murder plan, that gave the police what they needed to get into the house to see what else was in there, according to lead detective Chad Weaver of the sheriff's office. Now, once there, investigators were stunned to find a murder plan similar to the one Sanchez described, crumpled up in the trash can in Bender's home office. They also found ammunition and shell casings similar to the rounds found at the crime scene. Now, Weaver said those discoveries gave them enough probable cause to get an arrest warrant for Bender for De Lacerda's murder. And when Bender's trial began in May of 2021, Devani and Sanchez, the two women who at one time were at the center of his life, would once again come face to face, but this time to testify against him. Next on the docket, a bizarre and somewhat scary case in Atlanta. The Atlanta Medical Examiner's Office has released the autopsy report for a woman murdered in Piedmont Park over the summer. Now, Catherine Katie Janice, she was 40, was stabbed to death along with her dog, Bowie, in the park early on the morning of July 28th. The Medical Examiner's report released Friday revealed that Janice was stabbed more than 50 times in the face, neck, and torso. She also suffered blunt force injuries to her face, neck, and extremities. Her throat was slashed and the letters A and T were etched into her body, according to the medical examiner's report. Now, the medical examiner ruled Janice's death a homicide and said she died of sharp force injuries that caused major damage to her blood vessels and organs. Now, the night that she was killed, Janice had dinner with her wife, Emma Clark, and then took her dog for a walk in the park. When Janice didn't come home, Clark pinged her phone. Clark went to the park where she found the disfigured body of Janice and her dead dog near the 10th Street entrance. The FBI joined local law enforcement in the investigation of Janice's homicide in August. Police have not released any leads and they have no potential suspects. Someone, somewhere, knows something. But that is not a normal homicide. That just is very, very odd. All right, Ghislaine Maxwell, she speaks. But does she speak of the allegations? Oh no, no, no. She speaks about her conditions. She said that she has to give up showering because prison guards watch her constantly. Maxwell also told a news outlet that friendly rats visited her in her jail cell after a sewer was left uncovered. And according to Maxwell, she said, quote, I used to go to the loo with an open sewer drain and a friendly rat would regularly visit. I told the guards, but nothing was done until the rat popped out and charged a guard who screamed in terror. Finally, the sewer drain was covered. She also complained of rotting food. She also complained of rotting food, including an apple with maggots in it, after repeated applications for bail were declined by Judge Allison Nathan. Maxwell also complained of lights in her cell keeping her awake and being disturbed by constant checks from prison guards on strict orders to ensure she does not meet the same fate as that guy named Jeff. Now, Maxwell's lawyers have also complained about significant negative media attention the Epstein story has garnered, suggesting that she may not get a fair trial. She told the newspaper, I am terrified. The overwhelming negative coverage will poison my jury pool and affect the outcome of her trial. Now, despite the evidence, which she feels is quite confident will prove that she is innocent, she looks forward to having her day in court to prove that she played no part in that guy named Jeff's crimes. She is innocent. Well, the United States Attorney Audrey Strauss refuted a raft of Maxwell's allegations, including that she had lost weight and her hair was falling out in an April filing. Strauss's letter to the court read the defendant is 5'7", meaning that even her lowest weight of 130 pounds results in a BMI of 20.8, which is considered a normal weight for a person of defendant's height. Maxwell has also received the full COVID-19 vaccine and has been assessed by the medical staff as physically healthy. Now, the British socialite appeared much more glamorous in her court on Monday, having styled her hair into a shoulder-length bob with a grain roots touched up and dyed black. She also ditched her prison-issued blue top and pants for street clothes, a black turtleneck and gray slacks. She appeared healthier and more relaxed than she had in months as she attended a pretrial hearing in which the judge spoke about how she will be proceeding with jury selection. Now, Maxwell's newfound confidence was apparent at the end of the hour-long hearing when she stood face-to-face with her lawyer, Jeff Pagliuca. Pagliuca smothered a few loose strands of Maxwell's hairs from her face in an affection moment between the two. Well, I'm sure it's absolutely nothing but professional. Now, for those of you who don't know, Jeff Pagliuca resides here in the, well, state of Colorado. He works for a firm called Haddon Morgan Foreman. Ever heard of him? That's right. Represented the people that represented JonBenet's family, the parents. Oh, and that guy named Kobe as well. Look out. The defense is going to bring everything. They're very skilled attorneys. We give Ghislaine Maxwell the presumption of innocence, and let's see how the evidence comes out. All right, next on the docket, an example of evil. Now, two Arkansas men admitted that they were, well, trafficking a six-year-old, but also assaulted her, leaving her with an STD. Now, on November 11th, the United States Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Arkansas reported that DeMarcus George, 27, and Mario Waters, 33, pled guilty to conspiracy to traffic this child. Now, while George pled guilty last Wednesday, Water pled guilty the week prior. The victim was taken to the Arkansas Children's Hospital in 2018, where it was determined that she had received an STD. The child spoke to an FBI agent and revealed that she had been assaulted. Now, authorities later determined that the suspect to be George. The victim said that another man, determined to be Waters, had also assaulted her. The child said that the incident happened in a hotel room where a curtain was placed in the middle to separate the two beds. And although the victim didn't know the name of the hotel, the description she provided to investigators helped them locate it. Financial receipts indicate that the child's mother rented the hotel room with her credit card. And according to the physicians at the Arkansas Children's Hospital, the victim had more than one STD and likely developed them after multiple assaults. This led investigators to obtain DNA samples from the suspects. Both of the suspects' results were positive for different STDs. Now, in court, both suspects admitted that they had been inappropriate with the girl and basically tried to sell her. That's right. The unspeakable crime committed against this child reminds us how vitally important it is to have law enforcement officers willing to investigate and put a stop to these horrific crimes. That was according to United States Attorney Jonathan Ross. Now, these guilty pleas will spare the young victim from having to relive her experience on the witness stand at trial, and our law enforcement partners work hard every day to protect children from this abuse. And our office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, will continue to aggressively pursue those who commit these deplorable crimes. Now, both suspects are scheduled for a sentencing hearing at a later date. Now, we can obviously say that since they have pled guilty, well, that they are scum, okay? 6 years old, really? Come on. That's just wrong in any world that one could possibly live in. And since they have pled guilty, they no longer have the presumption of innocence. Let's hope the judge gives them the maximum. Let me know. Do you think they deserve any mercy? I'm not sure. All right. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Crime Talks, dumb criminal of the day. New Jersey State Police say they are looking for a suspect who is wanted in connection for allegedly stealing two trailer ramps from a business on Route 206 in Tabernacle Township, New Jersey. The unidentified man arrived at Rainbow International and inquired about purchasing the trailer ramps through the company's Ring doorbell. Apparently, after not getting an answer from the Ring doorbell, he decided to take matters into his own hands. Not knowing that the Ring doorbell was recording him the entire time, the suspect is caught on video entering the property, removing two trailer ramps, and departing the scene on foot carrying the ramps.